compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Happy Monday morning to you. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Hope you had a great weekend. Cyrus, did you have a great weekend? It was hot.
It was awesome. I think
hot and humid.
I grilled out more this weekend than I have in my entire life.
Yeah?
It was great. Very enjoyable. How about you?
So, lots of grandkids in the swimming pool over the weekend.
Oh, that's fun.
It was great.
You shock it after they go home,
do I
right?
Shock it? Do I ever shock it? Oh, man. You know, when there's all those grandkid bodies floating around for hours on end, and then the occasional adult that cannonballs in.
Yep.
I totally shock it. Well, good. I hope you had a rested weekend. We have a lot of work to do today. The number, first of all, 888-914-9149. That's the number to call to be on the program, 888-914-9149. I have some audio I want you to listen to. This first one here is from Justice Clarence Thomas. And he's talking about, with regard to racial discrimination, and as you know, the new critical race theory is part of this charade of ostensibly opposing racism, which I'm all in favor of. Let's oppose racism, but let's oppose it in every form. And he's responding to that very issue by talking about how, with regard to race and racial prejudices, there is no such thing as good discrimination. In other words, you can't apply a racist principle or action against one group of people based on their skin color and call that good while ostensibly trying to fight against racism. It'll be clear. Here's him talking about this as in his capacity as a justice on the Supreme Court.
Show me in the Constitution where you get a right to separate citizens based on race. I think what we've become comfortable with is thinking that there is some good discrimination and some bad discrimination. Well, who gets to determine that? And if you look in the briefs and the race cases, the segregationists, the people who thought you should have a separate system, they said that they thought it was good for both races. So they thought it was good discrimination.
That's exactly right. There was even a movement for some time in the 19th century to try to get actually, it was under Teddy Roosevelt. I take that back. Under Teddy Roosevelt, who was president, all of a sudden when William McKinley was assassinated, he was vice president, and so he immediately became president. So this was what, 1902, I believe it was, or 1901, right around there. I have to go back and check. Well, Teddy Roosevelt, for all of his strengths, and he had many, there was much to admire about him, but he was among those who wanted to find an island or a piece of land in the Caribbean that could be given to the slaves and former slaves and sons and daughters and grandchildren of slaves in the United States, where they could all go and be there by themselves if they wanted to have this opportunity. And it never actually worked out, but he worked really hard to try to make that happen. And it wasn't, you know, it's hard to tell looking back on it now after all these years, was it really out of racial hatred or was there sympathy or a mixture of both or what actually happened? I never saw him as an example of racial bias. He was among the first to ever invite a black man to the White House for dinner with the president, and that caused all kinds of fury. So even though he was a kid, he was about 5 or 6 years old when the Civil War ended, so he didn't have any adult role in the Civil War. He certainly lived as a young man through the Reconstruction era and the rise of the Jim Crow laws, and he was definitely at odds with those who wanted segregation of black people because they feared them or they thought they were inferior or whatever their nonsense was. And he never seems to have bought into any of those things, but he was sympathetic to the idea that, you know, maybe the right thing to do is provide a place where if they want to go there, they can go there and they'll be free from Jim Crow and they'll be free from all the other things that were going on that were harmful to them in this country. It never got off the ground. It never went anywhere. But we've seen before efforts to try to separate the races by race, thinking that, oh, well, this will be good for both groups. And of course, that is not the answer. It doesn't seem to work out whenever it's tried. And I don't recommend that we try it. But this is part of the simmering cauldron of anxiety and anger and all of the things that are going on in this country right now. This certainly plays a part in it. Now, not to be outdone, the good people at Hasbro. Now, Hasbro, as you know, is a toy manufacturer, and they make lots of very popular toys for kids. I used to play with them when I was a kid. G.I. Joe. Back when the G.I. Joe dolls were about 11 inches high, not the little guys that they came out with later in the 80s or 90s, but the full-on real G.I. Joe dolls with the army clothing and the guns and the space capsules and the tanks and all those things.
Kung
I
Fu
had
grip.
Lots of fun. Yeah, with Kung Fu Grip, yeah. Yeah, the one hand was always in that Kung Fu Grip, and that was to hold the gun. Because you got to have a gun or a knife or something, right? If you're going to be playing all those war games. You had G.I. Joes. Were they the little ones by the time you got onto
Oh, yeah. G.I. Joes? I had the little action figures. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd see your G.I. Joes. You know, someone would have an old G.I. Joe, and I'd be like, oh, it's a doll. Mm-hmm. Why would I play with that?
It was. That's true. I mean, it was essentially the same size as a Barbie, but they were cool.
Oh, yeah. They're awesome. Now, as an adult, those are cool. Those are
I wish
cooler
I had
than
kept
my little...
mine.
Rubber band held together ones. Yeah.
I wish I had kept mine. I really do. I mean, I had a lot of them. And my favorite G.I. Joe gift ever when I was a kid, Cyrus, was this would have been, it was the same year as the moon landing. Yeah, Apollo
69?
Yes. And I actually watched it on TV because it landed, I think it was about, I don't know, 7 o'clock in the evening, something like that, 6, 7 o'clock. Or not when it landed, but when Neil Armstrong got out, when he took the first step for man, giant step for mankind. I think he muffed his line. But in any case, we all gathered around the black and white TV, my mom, my dad, me, my two little sisters, and we sat on the couch and we watched it on live TV. It was just amazing. Walter Cronkite. And that's the way it is. He was narrating. But during that time, the Hasbro people, they produced a treasure house of toys for guys like me who loved the space program, who were all over the whole astronaut, you know, Mercury, then Gemini, then Apollo. And my favorite Christmas was the year that my parents got me a Mercury Redstone G.I. Joe space capsule. This thing was big. It's like bigger than your toaster. It's about as big as your bread box in your kitchen. And it had a visor that, you know, it had a window that you could slide open, put the G.I. Joe in there. There was a space suit with a space helmet and the whole works. I've never forgotten that toy. I don't know what ever happened to it. But man, did I just love that stuff. So I have a fondness for Hasbro, at least, you know, a kind of reminiscence of my childhood and some of the fun toys that they made. Mr. Potato Head, there's another example. Lots of people have played with Mr. Potato Head for many years. The reason I'm getting into all this is because Hasbro's in the news because there is a whistleblower, and you'll hear from him in just a minute. His name is David Johnson. And he's saying, wait a minute, time out, guys. First of all, David Johnson is black. Not that it matters one way or the other, but he's black. And he is, well, maybe we should just hear from him. But here's the point. Even Hasbro is into the whole critical race theory thing. And even Hasbro, in a subliminal manner, is giving special training to its employees. They're also, as you'll hear him talk about, in the works with the way in which they advertise their toys as a way to promote critical race theory. You may say, oh, come on. We're talking about Mr. Potato Head. We're talking about G.I. Joe. Well, listen to this guy. This is courtesy of Project Veritas. They're an undercover journalistic outfit, and they go undercover and they find what's really going on. In some cases, that might be very shocking to you, and I thought this was worthy of your attention. So here's David Johnson. He's a packaging engineer for Hasbro, and he's talking about what's really going on inside.
My name is David Johnson. I'm a packaging engineer for Hasbro. They are attempting to covertly push CRT, critical race theory, through branding and messaging through their products.
Explain what we're looking at here.
This is the program developed by the Conscious Kid, which is working with Hasbro to teach children about racial bias at an early age.
By 3 to 6 months, babies are beginning to notice and already express preference by race.
By age 3, children are already starting to apply stereotypes. They also may use racist language intentionally at this age.
This is critical race theory in practice. It's a mainstream ideology now, and it's in a lot of our institutions. People that I've spoken to about these issues, and I'm trying to explain to them why teaching people to segregate based on race or by gender or by any other inherent characteristic is wrong. If you want your children to be looking at people based on their race, then you are opposing Dr. Martin Luther King's dream. So I think that's progress in the truest sense, that we should not be judging each other by the color of our skin, but rather by the content of our character and actions. If the next generation of children is allowed to be indoctrinated to believing that racial segregation is a good thing, I don't think it will lead our country to anywhere good. This isn't something I wanted to do. This is something I felt I had to do. This is a hill worth dying on. If I can make one person just step away from this ideology and say, you know what, maybe that's not the way, it's not the path towards a better future, then I think it's worth it.
I wish they would get rid of that patriotic music in the background. I think that kind of lessens the impact.
Yeah.
Just
let the man speak.
I know, yeah, just let it speak for himself. All the window dressing is unnecessary. Now, this is about a 7-8 minute video all told, right, Cyrus?
Yeah,
you can't
play
all of it right now.
9 minutes.
9 minutes.
But it's worth watching.
Where can people see this? Because there's much, much more, and he gets into examples of how the good people at Hasbro are not just indoctrinating their employees, but also are intent upon indoctrinating you and your kids through the commercials for their toys. Where can they listen to this?
I'm putting this on our Twitter feed right now.
Okay. And tell the good people where
so
it is?
Go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and it'll be right there at the top of the live Twitter feed that we display there. Or you can go to Twitter and find them.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. And just to kind of restate what I just said, this is the allegation that he's making. His allegation as an insider, and I'm pretty confident he doesn't work for Hasbro anymore. I don't know how that turned out, but again, courtesy of Project Veritas that goes undercover and finds some of these things that people and entities would rather you not know about. The allegation that he's making, and I think it's very compelling, the information that he shares, that Hasbro's completely sold out, or the people who make these decisions are completely sold out to critical race theory. Therefore, they are pushing it both on their employees and on the general public. That's the allegation. And you can decide for yourself if you think that allegation has merit based upon seeing this whistleblowing insider description of what's happening. Now, it's gotten so bad, Cyrus. I don't know if you've caught up with this news, but Asian carp, these are the fish, you know, the big, beautiful fish that are in ponds all around the world. Well, the Asian Carp Regional Coordinating Committee, following a recent rebranding movement concerned about racism, is going to change the fish's name to invasive carp. This is courtesy of the Daily Caller. That's how bad this has gotten, that they see this fish called Asian carp, comes from Asia, but they feel that that's racist. So they're officially, according to the Associated Press, they're officially changing the name of the fish from Asian carp to invasive carp. Minnesota Senators Fung Hodge and John Hoffman began the initiative in 2014 by instituting a measure by mandating that Asian carp be referred to as invasive carp by all Minnesota agencies. Other notable government agencies have fallen in line, including the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that began in April of this year, citing racism as a key factor in the redesignation. The director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's regional office, Charles Woolley, explained that the organization, quote, wanted to move away from any terms that cast Asian culture and people in a negative light. Now, let me pause there for a second. I'm completely on board with that. I don't want to put anybody in a negative light. I don't believe we should be doing anything that can be truly, you know, in actuality, harmful to any group of people, regardless of their skin color. But come on. The name of the fish has been Asian carp because that's where it originates. That's where it originally came from. And how is that racist? Is that any more racist than talking about Italian food or Chinese food? There are some people, believe it or not, who would say that's racist. And I know you're scratching your head and you're saying, how do they get racism out of that? I do not know, but they do. And the crazy thing is that the people who push those insane narratives are gaining ground. They're accruing power and influence, not only in academia, Hasbro. And so it's important that you know about just how silly so much of this is. But I don't want you to get the wrong impression. I'm not in any way making light of, or much less endorsing, any effort to be mean-spirited to anybody. Quite the opposite. I believe in, we should have fair play. We should be, as Jesus said, we should be charitable to all, right? The efforts, again, according to the Associated Press, the efforts to sanitize the term Asian carp are also spurred on by the fish's impact on waterways and the billion-dollar fishing industry. Varying species of Asian carp eat plants and seafood critical to marine life and cause collisions with boaters, according to the Associated Press. This is basically just a retread, because every single paragraph ends with, according to the Associated Press, or AP reported. Anyway, utilized only sparingly as bait and in a few other ways, campaigns like the Illinois Perfect Catch marketing strategy are being implemented to encourage others to fish for Asian carp as an attractive alternative source of fresh fish, the AP reported. Simply purging the Asian carp population is not a realistic option, according to the Asian Carp Regional. What about French fries, Cyrus? Is that racist? But I know France is not a race. French are not a race. But I'll bet you somebody somewhere will take offense at that, and we may have to change from French fries to maybe invasive fries. What would you? Can you think of an alternative?
Someone's probably very upset at you right now for making,
well, they have no
making
reason
light. You're making light of this super important problem.
With
this
all
the
crises.
Stuff, this is the stuff we should be worried about.
You're right. With all the crises going on, and you know, the fingers of despots, you know, on the button to launch waves of attacks against innocent people, not to mention all the other problems we have, this is a huge emergency, as we've got to rename this fish from Asian carp to invasive carp.
We need to move this to the top of the priority list.
Yeah, I think they have. So what is your answer to that? So if French fries is the next thing to tumble because somebody somewhere is offended by calling it French fries, what would be another option for that? Think about that. Put on your thinking cap and
maybe
let me know.
Fries?
that works. Nobody can be offended by it. But I'll bet you somebody somewhere will be.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know why.
Fries might be saved because you can call it fries, but French dressing, I sell your stock in French dressing right now.
Mm. Or just buy a bunch jokes of French dressing so that you can can corner the black market you can't get it anymore.
Yeah.
You roll up in your station wagon and you open the back door that flips down on the station wagon. You're, you know, some neighborhood, and you're bootleg selling French dressing to the black market. Yeah. I could picture it.
I'm sensitive to this. I can understand why some big companies have gotten rid of Aunt Jemima. There's history there. I get it. French fries.
If people are genuinely offended by that, and I can certainly see that more with Aunt Jemima, the pancake syrup, also and they
Uncle
changed
Ben's,
the picture
right,
a long time ago. Originally, the lady was in the, you know, kind of a bonnet or a kerchief of some sort. Clearly had the look of a domestic help person, and then Uncle Ben's rice. Now, there I would say, even though none of that ever offended me, I never thought about it that way, but I could see, that's not outlandish to me, to see people who are black being offended by a racial stereotype on a pancake syrup container. So I'm not opposed across the board by any means. But I do think that it goes too far in some cases. Here's another example. We have to go to a break, but I'll just pop this out there. Mark Zuckerberg, he is being accused. First of all, he's Jewish, okay? He's being accused of anti-Semitism because there was a photo of one of his pets. It was a Hungarian sheepdog, not was because the dog's still alive, named Beast, wearing a yarmulke and a canine-sized tallit, or Jewish prayer shawl. The post was quickly inundated with comments, most of them pushing a pro-Palestinian message, despite the photo's lack of Israel-related content. This from the Jerusalem Post. Some of the responses included anti-Semitic rhetoric and imagery. Many contain the phrase Israel, Israel, R-E-A-L, terrorism. And some contain caricatures with large noses, et cetera, et cetera. So he just had a fun picture with his dog. You know, I personally would never put like a First Communion garment or something like that on a dog. I think that in itself is blasphemous. But who knows what he was thinking when the picture was taken. But now they're coming after him as being anti-Semitic. Anyway, what do you make of that, Cyrus?
I think, you know, everyone's free game to to be come after. Or
you better go back through your Facebook page as far back as it goes.
Yep.
And make sure you don't have anything that somebody somewhere at some point in the future might be offended about.
That's right. Cancel culture.
Yeah. Speaking of canceling, I think we had better take a break, right? We'll do that now. We'll come back to your phone calls. The number to dial is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
We're back. Thanks for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. Let's go to Lisa in Phoenix. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. I guess I just wanted to comment on what you had been talking about this morning in regards to changing the fish's name to invasive carp. I think that I agree with you in regards
Isn't it
to
silly?
That. It's ridiculous. I think that, you know, it's everybody's differences that make everybody so unique and that bring forth, you know, better inventions and newer ideas. And, you know, I think that, I think everybody just needs to lighten up and, we need to be able to poke fun at ourselves.
I agree. And I wish that people who were purveying this nonsense were normal like that, like what you're suggesting, but they're deadly serious about this. They're deadly, deadly serious. They're in earnest. And there's not much laughter coming from that corner of the room. I think that seeing this for what it is as being silly and saying so and laughing at it is the best way to defeat it. Because if you and I start taking this seriously, then they win, because then everybody is on board. And I don't want to see civilization trending in this direction, honestly. What do you think?
Oh, no, I agree with you. Exactly. I you know, I think that we need to embrace our individuality and our differences and, you know, be proud of who we are and just share who we are with one another and just be okay with it, you know. And if somebody wants to wish you Merry Christmas or, you know, Happy Hanukkah, just, you know, say, you know, whatever religion you want to say back to them. Don't, you know, don't hold back and say, oh, you know, Happy Holidays. or season's greetings. You know, just don't hold back from who you are as an individual. Just embrace it. And I think everybody just has to be okay with, you know, the diversity of the world, you know, because if there wasn't meant to be diversity, then God would have made everybody same race, you know, or the same. It's just, it makes no sense what they're trying
to
do.
There's a science fiction short story, Lisa, and I forget now whether it was Arthur C. Clarke, might have been Ray Bradbury, who was one of those guys, and it's all about how aliens come back to Earth, and they're making contact with Earth, and it's really good that they're there because they're there to help, and the punchline to the whole story is you get down to the very end, you know, we're here to help you, we realize that for some of you, you know, your skin color, you know, you turned the wrong skin color and all that. And so I forget exactly how it ends, but the shock ending, which I really enjoyed when I read it, was that originally all human beings were black. and that they had become various other colors. And that was the problem, was, you know, white or Asian, or not necessarily a problem, but it was a deviation from the original. So the way it's written, you would expect something opposite of that. And it was a twist ending, which your comment reminds me of. Also, if I can inject what you just said, you talked about diversity. And my thesis here is they don't really want diversity. Diversity, true diversity, which is what you're describing, I think that's wonderful. I wish we could have it, but they don't want that. They want to stifle the diversity and freeze out and foreclose upon those who disagree with them, or who, in this case, in terms of their racism, the people who have the wrong skin color. They don't want diversity. They really don't.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that people just have to really just start voicing their opinions and realize there is freedom of speech. And, you know, we have to be able to, you know, hey, if they're changing the name, that's fine. They can do that. But you know what? Everybody has to take control and realize that just because, you know, one corporation or one, you know, entity is changing something doesn't mean everybody has to follow. You know,
right.
I mean, we have the power. We are the people. We run the government. You know, I think that people have to realize that.
Do we really anymore, though? Let me play devil's advocate. I mean, I know that's true in theory. You work for me. You know, you're a senator, you're a congressman, you're the president, you work for me. But in fact, is that really true anymore? I don't think it's really true anymore.
It's, you know, I think that that's what they want us to believe. And I think that a lot of people do believe that. But, you know, there could very well be
a
revolution. Everybody, you know, I mean.
How do you feel about the fact that last week the White House revealed that it is, and this was Jen Psaki echoing what President Biden said, that they're in daily communication with the big tech platforms like Facebook and Twitter, and they consult with them on posts from individual people, like your Facebook page, Lisa. You have the White House consulting with Mark Zuckerberg and his people at Facebook, determining which of your posts on Facebook they don't like and they want taken down. That's happening, and they've admitted to it publicly.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And I have seen that.
That should scare everybody. I'm not here to scare anybody.
It is scary, yeah. It is scary, but I think also, you know, that fear should kind of empower everybody to realize, like, what's going on, and we need to really just stand up and, you know, if we need to write letters, if we need to protest, I mean, we need to, like, stand up for ourselves. But, I mean, with regards to Facebook, I have an account. I don't use it. So,
right. But you're in the minority. You and I are in that small minority, because I rarely, if ever, go on Facebook. People will send me a message on Facebook and say, hey, I messaged you like 4 months ago. Oh, I never saw it. But you and I are different from most people, Lisa. Most people are on Facebook. You know, it's just a fact of life.
Yeah. I mean, I hear my coworkers all the time, you know, on my unit, you know, they have like a Facebook page for the work unit that I'm on. And it's like a part of me wants to join just because I want to be a part of it. But another part of me is just like, no, I really just want to stay away from all that media, social media stuff. I'd rather just be real and be in real life and socialize in reality.
I agree. I don't look down upon anybody who likes Facebook or any of, I mean, I'm on Twitter. That's my big thing. But I don't deny that there's some great value there, and it's a wonderful tool, you know, see your grandchildren's pictures and things like that. I mean, yours, because you're too young for grandchildren, but you get what I'm saying? In other words, it's good, but also it can become, well, we don't have to get into the, you know, how some people can be enslaved by it. So bottom line for you, Lisa, as you consider the Asian carp story and the other ones like it, what's your prescription for improving the situation?
First of all, call it what you want. You know, I mean, I'm going to call it Asian carp. That's forever what I'm going to call it. And I think that it's a difficult situation, honestly, because what I've seen is, you know, the people with the power or the money, you know, they are the ones that write the history books, you know, and this is just getting into a big bowl of stuff, but, you know,
what about white bread? What if they decide that the term white bread is racist and we have to call it something else. What about the city of Columbus, Ohio? I've said this before, and I know people think I'm kind of crazy for saying this. I would not be the least bit surprised. I wouldn't be happy about it, but I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if in their furor to erase and expunge anything that has any connection whatsoever to racial issues, I will not be surprised if Columbus, Ohio is eventually forced to change its name. I know it sounds crazy, but we're moving in the crazy direction. So,
yeah, we are. I mean, even in Arizona, there's a hiking area that I used to go to. It used to be called Piestewa Peak, and then they call it something else now. They changed the name because they found it offensive to, Indian race.
If I remember correctly, don't they have a freeway named after a young woman, if I'm not mistaken, who died in the first Gulf War? And that was her last name, and I believe she was Native American, and she died in battle in some fashion, I forget now. So to honor her, they named that freeway after her, and the one that goes up into Scottsdale on the more west side, I guess. But anyway, so now they find that name offensive. It's the name of a person.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that what we have to do as people is teach our children, teach our children.
Lisa, forgive me. Your phone is starting to act up. It's starting to hurt my ears. Sorry about that. But do call again. I enjoyed this fascinating conversation. So, Jim, you had a couple of comments. What were your comments on this? Jim, he's being shy. All right. Well, maybe we'll get Jim on the phone or on the microphone at some point. Let's go to Peter in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. I'm an old timer now, and I started my career as a baseball writer. And one of the wisest things I've learned, and I've learned it several times since then in dealing with American history, is you can't judge someone outside of their own era. When I was a young guy, we used to get talking between innings, things like, who's a better pitcher, Sandy Koufax or Walter Johnson, or how would Ty Cobb do against modern pitchers, or things like that. And an old-time baseball writer that was working with us, he said, boys, you can't judge anybody outside of their era. And
what does that mean, though?
Just back. Well,
here's why I asked the question. Adolf Hitler died 76 years ago. So he's not in our era. He was in his era, and very few people are still alive who were from that era. Does that mean we can't judge him and what he did?
Well, I would say he's an extreme example. I think
what
Teddy
about slavery?
Teddy Roosevelt is better.
Okay, well, you go ahead. I'm not trying to dog you. Go ahead, please.
Well, here's an example. We've been studying family history. And one branch of my family has also lived in Wisconsin since the 1840s. But when they came to the United States, they looked at real estate seriously in the South. They liked the climate. They liked the people. And a couple of his brothers were already settled in Wisconsin, and he wrote a letter to them saying, I really like the people. I like the climate. I'd like to grow tobacco down here. But I cannot afford 4 slaves that I would need to grow tobacco successfully in this area, and I don't know what to do. And they wrote back to him, why don't you come back to Wisconsin? The real estate is reasonable. You don't need slaves. And, we're selling grain here and raising some cattle. Things are working out okay for us. And he went back to Wisconsin and settled. I really don't think great-great-great-granddad was a racist. He was just operating out of what he knew and what was going on at that time.
Mm-hmm. I don't dispute the point you're making. In other words, that we have to take into account circumstances, cultural conditions, level of knowledge and things at the way they were in those days. I agree with that theory. But I don't think it can be an absolute. You can't apply it absolutely and say we can't judge anything or anybody ever because it was in a different time.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that either, but...
Okay.
Well, frankly, I think Ty Cobb would do very well against modern pitchers. And I think It's one of those things to think about. If Wisconsin seceded from the Union, like Robert E. Lee, I don't think I could fight against my fellow neighbors and friends in Wisconsin. I just don't think I could do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other people have different opinions.
I hope that's not a question we ever have to face in our lifetimes for real, but it's possible that things could get to that point. I hope they don't, but these are not idle thoughts. These are good thoughts to ponder, I think.
Well, thanks for your time. Thanks for putting up with an old-timer.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for listening to the program. This is break time, so we'll do that. Come right back for more of your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Also want to talk a little bit about what Pope Francis announced the other day with his motu proprio about the traditional Latin Mass. I've received a couple questions on that. I thought I would respond to those as well. On the other side of this quick timeout, you're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Great song for a Monday morning. Let's have a great week this week, shall we? Welcome back. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Becky in Austin, Texas. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question about Pope Francis's recent motu proprio letter that he put out. Mm-hmm. And one of the things in it says that the Latin Mass will not be able to be in parochial churches. And I don't know whether that means the communities, the Latin Mass communities that are already in existence, or just new ones, or what. And another question is, first of all, I'm not sure what is meant by parochial churches.
We can take care of that one. Yeah, so a parochial church is a parish church. That's just another way of saying it.
But my most perplexing question is, where on earth would they go? If they couldn't go to the parish churches, where would they go?
Yeah, that's not specified in the document. So you could surmise maybe at a chapel at a cemetery. For many years, at a cemetery.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's just one option. So here's some thoughts, first of all. For many years, the traditional Latin Mass was celebrated at a chapel in the major Catholic cemetery in San Diego, where I used to live for years. And so the Latin Mass community didn't have the option of attending the traditional Mass at a parish in the diocese, but it was permitted at the cemetery. So that's where the traditional Catholics who wanted to go to that Mass would go. It could be held outdoors. It could be held in a shrine, something that's not a parish. I mean, there seem to be options, but of course the most convenient option would be what had been done for 1500 years roughly, was to celebrate the traditional Mass in your parish where they were always celebrated. But that is now proscribed. So that is that I think remains to be seen what are the options. But let's go back to your first question, Becky. What was it again? I think I've forgotten the first one.
Does that mean that Latin Mass communities that are in parish churches right now, they are going to have to leave and go find something else, or does that just mean pertain to new communities that might want to start up? For instance, maybe there's a Latin Mass community in one part of town, but another one in the opposite part of town far away wants to start up, and they're the ones that aren't going to be in a parish church.
Well, yes and no. So the motu proprio itself, it stipulates several things that must be done and must not be done. So I'll just read those verbatim so that you're familiar with it. I read the entire document on the air. with some commentary on Friday, so you can go back and listen to it there if you want. But here are the stipulations. This is the first one. The liturgical books promulgated by St. Paul VI and St. John Paul II in conformity with the decrees of the Vatican Council II are the unique expression of the lex orandi of the Roman Rite. That's basically saying that the new Mass, as promulgated by Pope Paul VI from Vatican II, this is the way we're going to celebrate Mass. This is the unique expression. What I understand that to mean is this is the norm. And the lex orandi is the law of prayer, the law of praying in the Roman Rite. The next point, it belongs to the diocesan bishop as moderator, promoter, and guardian of the whole liturgical life of the particular church entrusted to him, that's referring to his diocese, to regulate the liturgical celebrations of his diocese. Therefore, it is his exclusive competence to authorize the use of the 1962 Roman Missal, that's referring to the traditional Mass, in his diocese according to the guidelines of the Apostolic See. Number three. The bishop of the diocese in which, until now, there exists one or more groups that celebrate according to the Missal antecedent to the reform of 1970, and that is referring to the traditional Mass, one is to determine that these groups do not deny the validity and legitimacy of the liturgical reform dictated by the Vatican Council II and the Magisterium of the Supreme Pontiffs. That's another way of saying that they cannot deny the validity of the Mass in the new ritual as promulgated by Pope Paul VI. The second point, the bishop is to designate one or more locations where the faithful adherents of these groups may gather for the Eucharistic celebration, not, however, in the parochial churches and without the erection of new personal parishes. So that gets to the heart of your question. For those people who are currently attending the traditional Latin Mass in their parish, that Mass now must be moved to some other place, and the bishop is now in charge of figuring out where that place will be. Will it be a cemetery chapel? Will it be some other place? That's something he has to determine, but they're no longer, at least as I read this, allowed to have Mass in a parish church, a parochial church. And this also, to your question, means that if another parish across town says, well, we'd like to add a traditional Latin Mass, that's now prohibited. The next point is the bishop should establish at the designated locations the days on which Eucharistic celebrations are permitted using the Roman Missal promulgated by St. John the 23rd in 1962, traditional Latin Mass. In these celebrations, the readings are proclaimed in the vernacular language using the translations of the sacred scripture approved for liturgical use by the respective episcopal conferences. So unlike how it has always been, where the readings of the Mass were proclaimed in Latin, that is now prohibited. And so even at those traditional Latin Masses, the readings are going to be proclaimed in the vernacular, Spanish, English, Tagalog, what have you. The next point is the bishop is to appoint a priest who will be his delegate, and it explains the qualities in mind and such. The next point after that is the bishop should proceed suitably to verify that the parishes canonically erected for the benefit of these faithful are effective for their spiritual growth and to determine whether or not to retain them. In other words, there's a kind of implicit suggestion there that the bishop may want to suppress those Latin Mass communities if he feels that it's not helpful. That's the implication. And then the next point is that the bishop is to take care not to authorize the establishment of new groups. That also gets to the heart of your question. So if a new group says, hey, there's 500 of us, so we'd really like a Latin Mass, or there's 50 of us, the Pope's motu proprio specifically says that is not to be authorized. The next point, priest ordained after the publication of the present motu proprio, that is those who are ordained Friday or later, Friday of last week or any time in the future, who wish to celebrate using the Missale Romanum of 1962, should submit a formal request to the diocesan bishop, who shall consult the Apostolic See before granting authorization. Now, this is a curiosity in this document, if you ask me. Because at the beginning, it says that the bishop is the sole competent authority to make these determinations for his diocese. And yet in this section, it says that even the bishop, who is the sole competent authority, even he is not permitted to just grant Father McGillicuddy's request to celebrate the traditional Mass. He then has to take that up with the Holy See and ask permission of the Holy See and get permission of the Holy See before he can grant permission to the priest. That seems to be at odds with the provision earlier, which says that the bishop is the, he's the, you know, ultimate say on this matter. The next one gets into priests who already celebrate according to the traditional mass, that they should request from the diocesan bishop the authorization to continue to enjoy this faculty. Institutes of consecrated life and societies of apostolic life erected by the Pontifical Commission Ecclesia Dei fall under the competence of Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies for Apostolic Life. The Ecclesia Dei Commission was basically shuttered earlier. The Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments and the Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life for matters of their particular competence exercise the authority of the Holy See with respect to observance of these provisions. As I understand that, that means that the Holy See, the Pope, is saying when they make a decision, they have the full faith and backing of me. Previous norms, instructions, permissions, and customs that do not conform to the provisions of the present motu proprio are abrogated. And then the conclusion is, everything that I have declared in this apostolic letter in the form of motu proprio, I order to be observed in all its parts, anything else to the contrary notwithstanding, even if worthy of particular mention, and I establish that it be promulgated by way of publication in L'Osservatore Romano and then in the Acta Apostolicae Sedis. So that's it. I mean, that's the whole document. I only didn't quote to you one or two paragraphs at the very beginning. But that's it in a nutshell. So let me, first of all, thank you for the call, Becky. I appreciate it. So these are uncharted territories, if you ask me. I've never heard of these things happening before. Well, I shouldn't say I haven't heard of them. I mean, there have been times of great turmoil in the life of the church, so that's probably not an accurate statement. But at least in living memory, this kind of thing is highly unusual, and we'll see what happens as things go on. I do have some more that I want to share with you on this, including a question that came up this morning on Twitter about this issue. So we'll discuss that. And there's a helpful, this is a term you see everywhere now. It's called an explainer. It's kind of like the word guidance. You just can't get away from that word anymore. Everything is guidance this and guidance that. Well, explainers are kind of like a fact sheet that will give you the specifics about something. And in this case, I want to share one that I thought was very helpful. This regards the extraordinary changes for the extraordinary form of the traditional Latin Mass. I'll share that with you as well. And your phone calls as well, 888-914-9149. I also have a couple of letters, including one by Bishop Hying, who is the Bishop of Madison, Wisconsin. Bishop Donald Hying wrote a wonderful letter. He issued it on Friday in the aftermath of the Pope's motu proprio, and I would like to share that with you. We'll talk about that, plus what the Archbishop of San Francisco had to say, Archbishop Cordiglione. He had some responses as well, and these are in line with those of many bishops, it seems now, more and more throughout the country and even in other parts of the world who are offering similar responses. And I'd like to share those with you so that you can at least be aware of how some of these things are trending now since the big news on Friday of last week. The number is 888-914-9149. I'm going to take a break. I'll be right back with all of this and more, including your phone calls. So please stay right there. I'll be right back.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.